WIOX is supported by Silver Hollow Audio's CatsCast podcast, celebrating the Catskills. CatsCast is produced to deliver history, travel guides, arts and culture, outdoor adventures, sustainability news, and local interviews from New York's Catskill Mountains and Hudson Valley. CatsCast, K-A-A-T-S-C-A-S-T. CatsCast, available at CatsCast.com or wherever podcasts are available. WIOX is supported by Margaretville Hospital and Mountainside Residential Care Center, a member of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, offering compassionate care at a CMS nursing home. More information at 845-586-1800.
Hi, this is Mark Bierman, host of Mark Bierman Sports, Monday evenings at 7, and Mark Bierman Today, Tuesday and Wednesday mornings at 9. Individually and collectively, the fast is ours on WILX Roxbury. We are community radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WILXradio.org. Adios!
How are you today? This is Dennison, and you're listening to Through the Looking Glass here in 91.3 FM in the Catskill Mountains, where we are live today. And we have a great guest here on Looking Glass. We have John C. Manley. John has spent decades ghostwriting for medical doctors, as well as naturopaths, chiropractors, Ayurvedic physicians. John publishes a pretty incredible blog called the COVID-1984 Red Pill Posts. It's an email-based newsletter dedicated to preventing the governments of the world from using an exaggerated pandemic as an excuse to violate our freedom, health, privacy, livelihood, humanity. John's also writing a novel or a novella. It's a novel now, actually. It'll probably be a trilogy. Much to do about Corona, a dystopian love story. He has a tremendous website with lots of resources, especially if you want to know what's going on in another part of the world with Corona, their lockdowns, which are strict or were strict. John's from Alberta, Canada. We're going to go to an interview we had with John last week here on Through the Looking Glass. As you know, we try to look a little deeper in issues here. Always try to get to the bottom, little scratch below what the mainstream media will do here on The Looking Glass. So let's just jump to our interview with John C. Manley, and we'll start from there. Hey, John, how are you today? Welcome to WIOX Radio.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm need a haircut. My barber was told by my government that if he cuts my hair, someone in an old lady in a nursing home is probably going to die, despite the fact that the cause of death would probably have been more related to poor nutrition, lack of contact with other human beings, lack of ventilation, lack of sunshine, lack of fresh air. But no, it's most likely it was going to be due to the fact my barber cut my hair.
Well, your hair is pretty toxic from what I've heard.
Yeah, it's I got curly hair, so, you know, you got to keep it in lockdown.
Wow. God. So, John, you are prolific. I mean, you do a lot of writing for a living. You write for medical journals. You write for
I've never written for a medical journal.
Oh, okay.
I've written for medical doctors, but I don't. Usually I was writing books for doctors, not articles for journals. Okay. I was usually writing for the lay people.
Oh, great. Okay, that makes more sense. But you also have a real kick butt website, which I use quite a bit, actually, since I've discovered it. MuchAdoAboutCorona.ca. Can you tell our listeners how you started this website, in addition to the work you do, what it's about, what inspired you? We can go from there, because I think it's amazing all the sections you have on there and the resources that are available, the articles. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, I started that back in April last year, when probably just a week after the Prime Minister of Canada announced that he was putting us all in lockdown, which at that point to me, intuitively, it just sounded insane, but I wanted to look at the data, which was fairly scant at the time, which was part of why it seemed insane, because there wasn't enough data to justify what he was doing. But, you know, maybe his intuition was better than mine, you know, so I started doing research, and I put up the site MuchAdoAboutCorona.ca, and I picked that name because I live in Stratford, Ontario, which is Shakespeare's theater capital of the world, so it was a kind of a pun on Much Ado About Nothing. And I also had intended the site mainly just to educate my local population about why we shouldn't all be locked up and risking being hit by a car to avoid walking near our neighbor on the sidewalk. And I ended up getting more people visiting the site and subscribing to the site from outside of my city than within my city, who all kind of thought I was crazy. And from there, I kind of, I'm a writer by training and been a professional freelance writer for 15 years. So putting out a 500 to 700 word article every day was like nothing for me, particularly with such rich content available. Yeah. So I kept that up for months and months and months. And at the same time, trying to write a novel about the whole thing. And now I've kind of veered more towards putting most of my writing into the novel and less into nonfiction articles, which don't seem to be having the immediate effect I had hoped.
Right. Well, I guess it's the blog section where you list really a lot of just news of the days in little articles, interviews. I find that that has to be a lot of work to do that. And then you also have a news section, which, you know, it's pretty up to date. You kind of post things at least daily, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
So you are busy all over this this site. Now, you chose the title Much Ado About Corona, being Stratford. Stratford is Shakespeare's hometown, of course. Was there any other competing Shakespearean lines that you thought of for your website? It was Much Ado About Corona. Just that hit it from the top.
Yeah, I can't say I had any... Why do you have one?
Yeah, I was thinking as you came up, I didn't put Stratford together with the title. I love the title, but you could have put like One May Smile and Be a Villain. I mean, there's so many Shakespearean lines we could probably pull into today's world, you know, and I think that's why Shakespeare's hung around so long, because he does apply to the dynamics of power and corruption and betrayal from very top levels of government, doesn't he?
Well, and this whole Corona circus to me seems like one of his tragic comedies.
It does, unfortunately. I mean, it's almost like, where do you begin? And I want to talk about your novel, but let's first start with, like, I don't know, PCR tests. I guess that's where it all kind of began, didn't it?
Well, I'm not sure. I guess you could say that, but let's talk about PCR tests. It's hard to know where this all began.
Well, I guess just a whole lot of headlines and a whole lot of fear in the media is probably the original source of all of this. You know, I remember being in New York City in early March and being on the subway, and you know, New York City was becoming ground zero, certainly for this country. And the subways were the nuclear reactor core of ground zero. Everyone said you're in this hermetically sealed capsule underground with 85 people in the car with you. I mean, if you don't catch it in that petri dish, you're never going to catch it. And what I noted in all my rides then was I didn't even see a single person coughing. Not when I, because I was hyper alert for that. And it was just interesting. This thing spread the globe in 6 weeks, and here I am in the new ground zero after Wuhan and in Italy, northern Italy, and now if I hadn't watched the news, I wouldn't have known there was a pandemic, I guess is what I'm saying.
It's definitely, and I think that's still the situation. Though I suspect the reason you may have been seeing less people coughing on the subway, because I think anyone would have been terrified to cough on a subway. You'd think you get thrown out onto the tracks.
That's true. They probably got out at the next stop and coughed like crazy and got back on. But let's go to the PCR test, because, they're talking about reducing possible cycles in some countries, and Fauci's mentioned that you can't cycle this test over 35 cycles or it's no good. And I've heard other scientists say over 25 is no good. I think they've been routinely testing over 40 in this country. And the thing with the tests, as you know, the more you cycle it, the greater the chance it's going to pick up pretty much everything that happened to swat by your nasal passage. And you may locate a virus that you were never actually infected with. You may locate a virus that you had destroyed and never got a symptom from 4 years ago. What's your take on this test, and why is it still out there? It seems like to me that's the straw that would break the camel's back with all of this, when the faultiness of the testing gets exposed.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, even back in August, like in 2020, the New York Times published a full article pointing out that the thresholds were too high, and that was 6 months ago. I actually have it here. Like, they had a quote from a virologist from the University of California, Juliet Morrison, and she said, you know, right out frank, she said, any test with a cycle threshold above 35 is too sensitive. I'm shocked that people would think that 40 could represent a positive. And then she went on to say that she thought 30 or 35, but 35 max, but she said 30 would be the most ideal. Otherwise, she says, you're just increasing the chances of finding a positive by 1,000-fold. And this was printed in the New York Times. I mean, it's not exactly a rogue conspiracy theorist newspaper. So, you know, why are they doing this? I mean, that's just one example of one of the problems with the test. I mean, the other is we really don't know what the heck it's testing for anyways. When they developed it, they just sent it to Wuhan and tested the people there who were showing symptoms, and it said they were positive. So, but we don't know if they were, what they were looking for was a virus or just picking up some part of human esophagus. It's just a small bit of protein. So, I'm glad to see, like, with the election of your new president, which I'm not exactly saying I'm glad to see you got a new president, but, you know, it was like 1 hour after he was elected, the WHO admitted that, you know, there's a lot of problems with this test and the thresholds are too high. And we have seen in certain regions, including my province, where at that point, the number of cases dropped considerably.
Right.
Not that the media gave it much attention, like the Toronto Star, it was like a little paragraph on their COVID feed of fear. They have this feed where it's just like a giant Twitter feed just of telling you the latest things about COVID. And they just had one paragraph that said, due to new testing methods, there's been a dramatic drop in COVID cases. And then it went on to like four paragraphs about this 100-year-old man who just died from COVID.
Even the New York Times had an article on the PCR test in 2007. They talked about the epidemic that wasn't, and they were talking about the whooping cough. And they interviewed a Dr. Brooke Herndon, an internist at Dartmouth Medical Center, and basically they were talking about the article. The Times said, you know, the PCR test is just not a very good indicator of infection. And that's what we realized from this. You know, they were picking up false positives. And that was in 07, how quickly they forget, you know, and memory hold those things and then recycle this whole testing fear campaign all over again. I mean, a lot of people would claim the same thing about HIV and AIDS, that, you know, they never actually did identify that a singular HIV virus. You know, it's just assumed, oh yeah, we found the virus and now we're going to treat it. But it's never been isolated. And I've read the same thing about the Corona 19 variant, that they've never isolated it.
I'm not sure about the variant, but in some ways too, it's overlooking some of the problem, because even with the false positives, the tests are averaging between 3% and 5% positive rate, which is about the very, so you know, 100 people take the test, you're going to get 3 or 5 people who show positive. But we're talking a layer upon layer of lie here, because this test, even if it did what it says it's supposed to do, which is test for SARS-CoV-2, the virus, it's not what they're saying the test is doing. They're saying the test is testing for COVID-19, and that's not even the official story. I mean, it's testing for a virus that has been linked or proposed to cause COVID-19. But the way they're doing it is they'll test someone who has no symptoms whatsoever and then say that the test says they're positive. And let's say the test was right. They do got a coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus. But they don't have COVID-19 unless they actually have severe respiratory symptoms.
Right.
And this is, it's fundamentally the more obviously wrong thing, because COVID-19 is a disease, and any dictionary will say a disease has symptoms. And COVID-19, even though the symptom list is becoming so broad, the only thing we're really concerned about is when people exhibit severe, you know, what SARS stands for. What does it stand for? Severe acute respiratory syndrome.
Exactly.
And if you need a test to tell you if you have severe acute respiratory syndrome, you don't got it.
It's so true. I mean, when in history was someone walking down the street and they're completely healthy and told you're a case of Ebola, but you don't know it. You're a case of it, but suddenly you're a case of Corona 19 and you don't know it. You've got a deadly disease. You could kill grandma. And that's been the insidious thing, is the quote asymptomatic cases and the huge number of them, which makes like detection, where could it be? It could be anywhere, you know, and it I think heightens an unreasonable level of fear. And as you say, I don't think it's based on sound science at all.
Okay, this is Dennison, WIOX Radio, 91.3 FM here in Through the Looking Glass, a show every Monday from 9 to 10 a.m. We were with and are with John C. Manley, a medical journalist and novelist and blogster from Alberta, Canada, with a great website called muchadoaboutcorona.ca. We're going to go back to the interview with John right now here on WIOX.
Yeah, well, it's not even based on sound terminology.
Yeah,
being a writer, you know, I know what a word means. And when they say this test is testing for COVID-19, it's not. It's testing for a virus. So, I mean, a really great quote came from, I don't know if you know Dr. Roger Hodgkinson.
Oh, yes, I do.
Yeah, he was the former chairman of the Royal College of Physicians and of Canada. He was like in Ottawa, it's the Royal College for Pathology, and I forget the exact title. I think it's right here. Yeah, Royal College of Physicians of Canada Examination Committee and Pathology. So, you know, he's a pretty credible guy. But he's also the chairman of a biotechnology company in North Carolina that makes the PCR tests. And he said, I want to emphasize that a positive PCR test does not, and he says, underline in neon, mean a clinical infection. It's simply driving public hysteria. And all testing should stop unless you're presenting to a hospital. Because if you're going to a hospital and you got all these severe symptoms, the test is maybe kind of useful. I have no idea what for. But if you have all the other symptoms of acute respiratory syndrome, this test might just help them label it better. I don't know if it would actually change the type of treatment one would receive in the hospital, but...
Right.
But he's saying this guy's making money off the test, and he's saying that's the only time he thinks it could be a value.
And, you know, you're right. He's making the test, selling the test, profiting from the test, and he's admitting the test can't do anything in terms of diagnosing this infection. It can't.
Or very little. Yeah. Very little. He gave it a little credit. Otherwise, I assume he wouldn't be making them.
Well, he used the word hoax, didn't he? I mean, I heard a recording of him. I don't know if he knew he was being recorded. I think it was before a larger Zoom meeting or something.
He was at the Edmonton City Council meeting regarding, they were Edmonton for capital of Alberta, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah. I don't know, is it? Oh, no, capital. I don't know if it's a capital because it's Calgary. Anyways, it's in Canada. but, you know, it's a big city in Canada. And they were looking at extending the mask or planning to do a mask mandate, force everyone to wear masks. And he got up, well, virtually, and made that presentation. He didn't actually specifically say the PCR tests were a hoax. He just said the whole thing was a hoax, which, you know, he said that he thought the whole COVID-19 hysteria was the greatest hoax ever perpetuated on an unsuspecting public. He didn't try to mince words or anything, because I see a lot of people who know it's a hoax and they're trying to be, I don't know, politically correct. Like it's somehow unpolitically correct. It's just like you're a bad person. If you look something that's clearly a pile of lies, and you say it's a pile of lies, and it's to try to save a lot of people who are being harmed by the pile of lies, and for some reason that makes you a bad person, I don't understand it.
I know. I mean, even if you go to the CDC's own website, and there's the adverse reaction reporting element page on the CDC website, if you just cite to friends, family, anyone that you know over 1,100 and some people have been killed, reported death associated with the vaccine, and over 30,000 injured, people look at you like you're speaking a completely different language. You know, it just doesn't fit with it's a cognitive dissonance that takes place, I think, because this COVID narrative, I know in New York, it was sort of fear-induced. We almost got an injection of fear in March that caused trauma. And I used to work as a counselor with veterans, Vietnam veterans back in the day. And, you know, the trauma is real. And it might have been 30 years beforehand, the incident causing it, let alone 11 months beforehand. But it's almost like, you know, rationally, they would say, I know the enemy's not in my living room, they're not in my bedroom, but every night I have to wake up, run down to the kitchen, grab the broom, get back to bed, and I sleep with my broom, and I don't remember ever doing it. I just wake up with the broom every morning thinking it's my
wow.
You know, and so it's not a rational mechanism, the effects of trauma. And I do think that's somewhat in effect now, that it just really jars people. There's so much fear, and they're locked into the way of thinking, and the media keeps reinforcing, oh God, it's getting worse, it's gonna get worse, you know, it's gonna get worse, and sort of normalizing just a horrible existence to all of us, you know. And it's my biggest frustration, certainly on this show, is just feel like I get people who are knowledgeable and have a tremendous amount of resources and evidence behind them, and people don't want to hear it. I mean, for example, I saw on your site, one nurse called it pandemic theater, that the headlines are saying how the ICUs in that area of Canada were overwhelmed. And this nurse basically said, we're at 20 to 40% occupancy in the ICU, you know?
Oh, no, because I did that interview myself. Yeah. She said the emergency rooms were at 20 to 40%. The ICU was actually at 90%, which is still actually rather low for this time of the year. But the other key thing, I mean, this was a major, not the biggest hospital in the Toronto area, but it was a large hospital. It's not like a country hospital. Sure. And They only had 10 beds in ICU.
Ah, so 9 were filled and 1 was empty.
Yeah, and 2 of the beds contained someone over the age of 90 on a ventilator who had no possible chance of surviving. Mm-hmm. So...
And hospitals in general, I mean, a hospital's not happy if the ICU beds are 50% empty. It's almost like a hotel. I mean, certainly in our country, I don't know how it runs, the private system runs in Canada, but in our country, it's almost like a hotel with half the beds empty is like a prison for profit with half the cells empty is like an ICU unit in a private hospital with half the beds empty. It's a money loser in a sense, you know? So.
Oh, yes. And I mean, I found this wonderful article from the CBC back in January 22nd. So before they're even talking about a COVID pandemic in Canada, just before. And the CBC article is quite plain. It said, overcrowding has become so common in Ontario hospitals that patient beds are now placed in hallways and conference rooms, not only at times of peak demand, but routinely day after day. Oh, this was beautiful. And then they said, an exclusive analysis of data by CBC News shows that hospital gridlock, a phenomenon that used to be restricted to surges in patients during flu season, is the new normal. I just laughed with that term. They used the new normal before it had got here. But and then now we're in the exact opposite situation. We're in a pandemic and hospitals are under capacity this time of the year for the first time in probably a decade.
I know that hospitalization numbers are dropping fast in New York right now. And as you said, you know, after Biden gets in, the testing cycles go down, so they'll detect fewer positive, quote, cases. And you've also got the vaccine's been rolled out. So they might say the vaccine, obviously, like the vaccine's having to have effect or something. Mm-hmm. You know, in other places in Europe, the sort of lockdown is kind of being lessened, and they're saying, oh, you know, the cases are down because we've lessened the lockdown. But despite the fact that in the same places or other places of the world, heavier lockdowns, you can't tell by lockdown versus no lockdown case numbers per society. If you saw a graph of every country, you wouldn't know which country locked down heavily and which ones didn't. Because you
you would, because you can see a peak of deaths at the beginning of a lockdown.
Okay.
Like, I mean, that's what they saw in England. I compared a graph between Sweden and England, and as soon as England kicked in its lockdown, the death rate just shot up, and Sweden's didn't change at all. And we saw this in France too, with 30,000 people dying within like a month. I believe the lock, especially for the elderly, the lockdowns killed them.
Well, yeah, I mean, for the elderly, certainly, because the despair and the loneliness is just overwhelming. But even the kids now, the youth are skyrocketing in suicides.
We don't have any official stats in Canada. They say they're saving those for November because, you know, there's no rush or anything. but the one thing that they have announced publicly in Canada that's out of control at the hospitals is with children is eating disorders, to the point that ERs, like one Toronto hospital said that they usually saw in a course of a year 100 kids come into the emergency room with eating disorders. And I figure if they're coming into the ER with an eating disorder, it means that they did something pretty severe, probably either binging themselves to the point of death or throwing up to the point of death. And this, in the last 12 months now, they've seen 1,000 kids come into this hospital. So a tenfold increase in near fatal eating disorders.
Oh my goodness.
And I could understand, you know, you got kids that you can leave them at home with all this junk food and nothing to do. and they're depressed, and they don't even have that motivation of trying to stay in shape, I guess, because they have friends that will see them. I don't know. It's painfully all bizarre.
It's frightening. I mean, I was a teacher in New York City for 34 years, public schools, and my good teacher friends are telling me what it's like now. You know, they say even the really good students, they're coming online like 3 or 4 times a week, and they're not always there. Like their screen's there, but I don't see them, and I have to call them back. And he goes, this was never the case. It's just kids are really not being pulled in. They're feeling depressed. They don't see the purpose of it. They're stuck inside. They can't see their friends. And if they do, it's through a screen, and that competes with their life. And there's only so many screens in a home, and there's multiple kids. It's just been a mess. It's just been a mess. So you can see why these kids are, they're in trouble. You know, they're really in trouble.
Because also I feel too, like I hope this won't offend you, but I've never been a big fan of compulsory public schooling. I don't know if you've ever read John Taylor Gatto's work. He won the New York State Teacher Award back in, 1990. Mm-hmm. And he got up and did a speech where he said that he wished he resigned, because he wrote that famous book called Dumbing Us Down, and then he went on to write Weapons of Mass Instruction. And where he was actually at the point where he was actually taking his kids and marking them as present and not having them come to school because he thought they could get a better education out of school. But it was interesting because they had an alternative environment to get their education. Like there was this one kid who he was always not showing up, and Gatto asked, why aren't you coming to school? And he said, well, it's because on Mondays I go help my uncle. He runs this furniture company. I help him. And then on Tuesdays I go to my aunt and help her with her flower shop. And he had like 5 relatives, and every day of the week he was helping. He goes, I'm going to be graduating soon, and I need to know how to survive, and I'm not learning it in school. So he says, I'll read whatever books you give me, but don't make me come to class. And so he just started marking them as a present. And he has all these stories of students he did this with. One who went on to work with the seniors and have them knit scarves.
And I don't want a V-A-C-C-I-N-E. My voice, my body, I keep saying that this won't happen to me, 'cause I'm free, I'm free, and my body, and my choice, but too scared to raise my voice, keep saying that this won't happen to me, 'cause I'm free, I'm free, I'm free, I'm free, I'm free, I'm free, I keep saying that this won't happen to me, 'cause I'm free. I'm free.
We've lost 200,000 restaurants are shut in the United States. 200,000 small businesses.
Yeah.
Just because, you know. And yet the box stores and the fast food chain restaurants never shut. Making record profits. Amazon making record profits. Whole Foods, groceries, record profits. And, you know, the average person's getting kicked in the teeth here. You know, and it's, I guess you have to, at some point in the spring, it was like, hey, you don't want the cure to be worse than the disease. And that was starting to seep into consciousness. And now it's just the government doesn't even really address it. It's almost like, what, was this part of your program or something? You know, a major transfer mm-hmm. of wealth, just like in 08 and 09, just big transfer of wealth from average citizens on up to the billionaire class. Nobody goes to jail. Nobody's questioned about it. You start to shake your head, you know, when these lockdowns become so arbitrary. And you can go to these giant stores. They don't test your temperature when you walk in. There's no one walking around. I've gone into the box stores and seen people with not mask wearing. I don't see social distancing. And yet the corner store is shut down at the time. It just doesn't, the science doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it's not science. Yeah. Well, it is science in the sense that it's a theory, but, you know, the scientific process involves having a theory, then you test it and then see what the results are, and that was never done.
Right. And science is about questioning, and you think since these things aren't seemingly work, we had strict lockdowns in areas where cases stayed pretty high and no lockdowns, Florida had very minimal lockdowns. Their cases are way below California, who locked down more severely than anybody else in the country. It has a younger population by far on average. And yet their deaths are very different, and it defies the, quote, science that they quote, rely on. So,
well, there's only been two, you know, really serious studies done on the effects of the effectiveness, I should say, of lockdowns. And both studies showed they found absolutely no difference in deaths from COVID.
Mm-hmm.
But there has been evidence of deaths from other causes, which I think explains the excess mortality that has been seen in the United States, which is a unique country, because most countries haven't seen any change in all-cause mortality.
Okay, WIOX Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains, 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXRadio.org, where it's also quite easy to donate if you like what you hear. This is Denison. You're listening to Through the Looking Glass. We are talking to Sean C. Manley, Canada, Alberta, Canada. John is a medical writer and has a tremendous blog called Much Ado About Corona.ca. We're going to return to Sean's interview here on Through the Looking Glass.
We saw a peak, and I think what happened with the beginning of the lockdown, because of that, those most vulnerable to death by lockdown, especially the elderly, died then, and they might have just died 3 months later anyways, so when you average it out. Fortunately, in Canada, we have, like, Dr. Ari, I think I'm going to pronounce his name right, Ari Jaffe. He's a specialist of pediatric infection, and he's a clinical professor with the University of Alberta, and he came out and he just said, any possible benefit these lockdowns have, we're doing 5 to 10 times as much harm.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he also made the other point, because, you know, what they're saying, they're kind of making this argument that we're comparing deaths versus economic prosperity. And he says that's not the case. He was actually quoted as saying it's rather COVID-19 deaths versus recession deaths.
Right.
It's lives versus lives. We know that unemployment kills people in more ways than one.
Poverty is a huge killer, and you can go anywhere in the world where it's impoverished, and you see that the lifespan's so much less. The diseases are more rampant. The levels of despair are enormous. Poverty's a killer.
Yeah, to a degree, like real poverty, yeah. I mean, there's this in-between where, you know, being rich can be a killer too. That's another issue. But like, I know that, you know, death rates actually went down during the Great Depression. And one of the reasons they attributed to that is because people had nothing to do, so they got enough sleep at night. And I think we've seen a bit of that, where there has been benefits unintentionally to the lockdown that I think will disappear. And that's why we haven't seen an increase in death. I think they actually, if they're really as psychopathic as they seem to be acting, that I think they were hoping the lockdowns and the masking and all these crazy restrictions and what, I don't even know what to call them, measures, torture, mm-hmm. Would have caused a higher death rate, and they could have blamed it on COVID-19, because they seem to be able to attribute COVID-19 to almost anybody. But instead, the death rates largely stayed the same, and I think that's because there just has been some benefits. I've never in my whole time in Canada, because I go jogging every day for an hour, mm-hmm. and when the winter comes, I hardly see anyone out. This year, there's tons of people outside exercising.
That's true, too. You see it here in New York. Absolutely.
And they're probably getting more sleep. They're eating at home, and they're eating good food. And because they're getting enough sleep, they're not taking stimulants and all these different forms. And, of course, we have the opposite problem of people who are dying from opiate overdoses like crazy in Canada. But it's kind of balanced out. Some people, it made them worse, and some people, it kind of upped their... And I guess it's a kind of a culling process, and I'm not recommending it. And I think the longer they would perpetuate these lockdowns, the less benefit we're going to see from them. But mm-hmm. but there has been some, and
one good thing about COVID too is the flu's disappeared. It's gone. You know, the CDC's not counting it. I think in England it was reported 98% reduction in flu cases. We saw that in the Southern Hemisphere. They're coming out of, you know, their last winter. They didn't see hardly any flu cases. It was all COVID. So
disease, which has the same symptoms. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, you can find that in the HIV history as well. You know, a lot of the areas that dominated HIV cases, you know, in different parts of the world, South Africa, Asia, Southeast Asia, South America, they also had tremendous respiratory issues. They had tremendous skin lesion issues because of the different viruses that were flourishing in an impoverished area. So suddenly they stopped calling it diphtheria, tuberculosis, and all these other things, and hepatitis, and it was all AIDS. It was all wrapped into this giant syndrome, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they increased the fear campaign, which then increased the funding, and it's got its own cycle, you know, a life of its own in a way.
Which fortunately, you know, I don't see many people worried about AIDS these days. That's the only hopeful thing, but AIDS almost seemed like a test run for this. There's a very good documentary on, well, I'm not sure if it's on YouTube, but it's online somewhere, by a producer, Ken McCarthy. He is actually from your area of town, your area of the country, Hudson River area, New York, called Fauci's First Fraud. And it shows how involved Dr. Anthony Fauci was with the AIDS hysteria, and how so much of it is so parallel to what's happening with COVID.
It's true. In fact, there's another documentary I saw recently called House of Numbers. And it also, I think it's on Amazon.
Oh, yeah, that's an old one, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
And that does also look at Fauci's role, among others, Gallo's role, and, you know, AZT. And that AZT killed more people, they believe, than AIDS now, looking back. Many studies have said that. And
this
acknowledges that with a lot of you know, eyewitness and physician reporting. It's really I was asleep during that time. I hadn't realized it, and going back through this crisis, looking back and seeing, they did this before, didn't they? You know, it's really. And then with the AIDS testing too, you know, you could be test positive in one country, fly to another country and be negative, because they had different categorizations for what determined AIDS, a case.
Yeah.
So, it wouldn't even just take the test. Along with the test, they had to have this oral questioning involved. And the oral questioning was hugely significant to this murky test results, whether they said, oh, no, you're negative or you're positive. And a virus shouldn't be based on, like, any kind of oral testimony. There should be a virus present in the blood or not, you know. It shouldn't be. What's your lifestyle anyway? You know what I mean? And that was part of the diagnostic process.
So. If you're trying to diagnose HIV, AIDS obviously would require more than just a positive viral infection. But though I personally don't think HIV had anything to do with the AIDS syndrome. I mean, the Fauci himself was right there at ground zero, and I think it was Los Angeles, and all the patients were people who were taking immune suppressant recreational drugs. So,
And there it is. It kind of begins that way. And it's disturbing in that he's gotten more and more powerful. I know Larry Kramer was a New York AIDS activist, probably the most popular AIDS activist in the United States in the 80s and 90s. And he's dead now. And he wrote a letter in, I believe, 88 or 90. To Dr. Fauci, an open letter. It appeared in the Village Voice here in New York, a weekly paper. And basically he said that you are a pimp for Big Pharma, you're a mass murderer, you've got blood on your hands. This is Larry Kramer, and I know before he died, Fauci visited him and they sort of patched things up 20 years later, but pretty damning statement at the time when AZT was being, you know, thrusted into people's systems. Largely untested, all sorts of harm. Now, John,
I think that either,
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that that's kind of an example, too. A lot of the motivation to get those AZT, and I think there were some other drugs, but that was the prime one, was not the government pushing it. They got the people to beg them to rush it through without proper testing. And I see the exact same thing happening with this COVID vaccine. They got them scared, and they got the people. They're like, I have no idea why anyone would want to get this vaccine. It has not been through thorough testing at all. And yet they got people basically begging for it. So, and that's why, I mean, we can point our fingers at a lot of the people at the top, but when it comes down to it, like, I don't know American law as well as Canadian, but if you want to open your business, go and open your business. If you don't want to wear a mask, don't wear a mask. I mean, the Canadian Bill of Rights protects us from this. And I'd say the American Bill of Rights is probably an even better Bill of Rights than the Canadian. Most Canadians don't even know they have a Bill of Rights. They think they have a Charter of Rights. So, I mean, a lot of it comes down to the people. They just got to not be quiet and do what's right instead of trying to get along with this groupthink lemmings pack going off the edge of a cliff.
Yeah, it is. I've been surprised at the level of non-thinking cooperation. Just, okay, what do you want me to do? We'll do it, right? Just as safe. And a system that is supposedly cares so much about us, but you find people who've been injured by the vaccine, you see their reports, they post things, and what hurts them the most, even more than the injury, is they feel the betrayal. It's like after they were injured, you would think, since the whole vaccine process is because they care about us and they want to keep us all safe. And yet, when you report a vaccine injury, well, what do you want me to do? Like, I'm sorry, you know, doctors are saying, I don't know what it is. This is all new to me. I don't know. And people get bounced around and they're not getting compensated as they feel they should. In fact, there's no compensation. There's no indemnity. I mean, there's perfect indemnity for the company. So where do you go? And I think that's the harshest reality for some people. When they trust, they follow the rules, they get injured, and nobody cares. It's almost like a lot of the soldiers who go off to war and come back. And, you know, they get a little stipend when they get back, and it's not bad, but it doesn't go up with inflation. And you find 20, 30 years later, a lot of the homeless men are Vietnam veterans. And what are the Iraq veterans and Afghanistan veterans? What's ahead for them down the road? And, you know, and that they start to see the level of care isn't always there. And I think it's that betrayal that really hurts people.
Okay, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio at 91.3 FM in the Catskill Mountains. We are talking to John C. Manley from Alberta, Canada. John is a medical writer, has a blog, Much Ado About Corona.ca, CA for Canada. And we're going to continue with John right now.
Yeah.
Oh, you got a book. Tell us about your book. This is fascinating to me, writing a novel about the pandemic, is it?
Oh, well, what pandemic? It's set in the pandemic, or the so-called pandemic. It starts in July of 2020 in a small fictional town in just on the border of Northern Ontario, right at the French River between where there's North and South. I actually started it as a short story. I thought, you know, we got this big story going out there, and people, the best way to brainwash people is with stories, and the government knows that, and I think that's what's happening. You know, Plato, I'm sure you realize, warned about this phenomenon of stories being able to shape people. You tell them a story and they'll believe anything. They don't need facts. Stories work at an emotional level. So I started writing a short story and then evolved into a novella, which is kind of a short novel. And then it became the size of a novel. And then it's kind of branched out into a trilogy. I've put all the focus now on the first volume. And it's always hard to talk about novels and not give away the story. But it starts in the first novel starts in July 2020 and will conclude only at the December 27th, 2020. So it doesn't cover a very large span of time. So it's the first novel is very much set in the world we knew at the end of last year. And then the second novel spans up until 2030 and becomes probably more of a science fiction story in some ways, though lately it seems we live in a really bad science fiction story.
Unfortunately, yes.
I mean, if this was a science fiction, like, that's what I joked about on my website at one point. I said, you know, this looks like what we're living in right now looks like a really bad episode of Doctor Who.
I know.
I mean, we would say this is just, I mean, like, the whole masking thing in particular has given it such an image of how ridiculous it is, because anyone who has studied the literature on masking knows there is not a bit of evidence to show that masking will stop infection from spreading. So with the book, though, I am trying to focus on, well, I think one of the hurdles people have with understanding this is a big hoax is they don't believe that the government would do something like this. So as the protagonist of the story, I've chosen, he's about 22 years old, he's Métis, which means that he's half European, half First Nation Aboriginal. Mm-hmm. And his grandfather, who's in a nursing home in the story, he is full Aboriginal Ojibwe. And if I'm not sure how well known it is in America, but Canada has, you know, officially come forth about 10 years ago and admitted that we've done the most horrendous things to Aboriginal children, spanning from, I got a thick book here called The National Crime, spanning from 1879 to 1986, where the Canadian government, in conjunction with the Protestant and Catholic Church, abducted Aboriginal children from their families, thousands and thousands, year after year, and force them into residential schools, which were essentially work camps, where the children were not only underfed, the Canadian Parliament signed bills giving them permission to do medical experiments on the children. Experiments including where they stopped feeding them and only gave them vitamin and mineral supplements to see if they could survive solely on pills. They were sexually abused, physically abused. Children would escape into the middle of the winter because they'd rather risk freezing to death in Canada than staying in the schools. And many, you know, this Wenjack and many stories of them being found frozen beside train tracks trying to find their way home to their villages. So I chose that, you know, having an Ojibwe now stuck in one of the nursing homes undergoing all the COVID restrictions, which I think are doing more harm than any possible good to this elderly, as just to parallel the fact that, yeah, this is a government you think you can trust. This is what they did. And they called, not only did they do it, but they said they were doing something good. They said they were helping the children and protecting the children. And the fact it went on decade after decade, and then you got thick books like this one, it's like 900 pages of government documents, one after the other, of inspectors going into these schools and writing reports about how horrible it was, how the children for the whole day, the only thing they ate was at lunch and it was a piece of bread and a raw carrot, and then forced back into the fields to do labor. So, I mean, that's the Canadian government for you. That's the stuff that we know about. So to say that, oh, this can't be a hoax because the government wouldn't do it is baloney. And so that's one thing I'm trying to weave into the story. It really deep historical roots. I mean, this is why it's taken me. I'm at 350 hours of work, and I'm still working on the first volume because I'm trying to make sure not only that it's I don't want it to be like Brave New World, you know, Huxley's book, because I felt that was a kind of a caricature. I don't want this to be a caricature. I want this to be a real, it's not 100% realism, but I want it to be something that people can relate to about real people. And that's why I don't have it in Toronto, New York. It's in a small town outside of Sudbury, Ontario. So it's dealing with the people that you maybe aren't being as affected as badly by this, but still. So, of course, the story will expand and it gets out of the little town. The little town's not going to even exist by 2030. My story takes much like what Ray Bradbury said, you know, author of Fahrenheit 451. He said, I don't write these stories to predict the future. I write them to prevent it. And that's what I'm trying to do here.
John, it sounds fascinating. And what ambitious work. I mean, you've got three volumes going. You're going into the future. I'm excited. When do you think the first volume will be? I know it's hard to say because there's other people involved in the production on the back end of it, of course. But when do you think it's going to be ready? Do you not like to do that to yourself?
Well, I've done it to myself several times so far, and I've been as accurate as Neil Ferguson with the COVID predictions. but it's coming down to the finish line. I kind of see it sometime in the spring. That would be my best hope at this moment.
This is great. John, we've hit that hour where I've got to wind down, but I want to remind our viewers, John C. Manley is a ghostwriter for Medical Doctors in Canada, Naturopaths. He's published a tremendous website called muchadoaboutcorona.ca, muchadoaboutcorona.ca. It's got tons and volumes of really great material chronicling what we've been going through and really COVID narrative breaking stuff too. So if you want to check out the other side of the headlines, it's such a great place. And obviously this book coming out. So anything else, John, you'd like to say before we bid you goodbye and hopefully get you on again at some point?
I think just really encourage people to be brave and follow their conscience.
Well said. John, thank you so much for the hour. I really appreciate your time.
No, thank you for having me, Dennison.
Okay, all the best to you.
All right, you've been listening to John C. Manley from Alberta, Canada, a medical writer, blogger, a novelist. He has a blog, muchadoaboutcorona.ca, has a lot of information and a lot of things that aren't promoted in the media you can find there as well as headlines for the media. Everything Corona you can find at his website. Again, John C. Manley, Much Ado About Corona. You've been listening to Through the Looking Glass here at WIOX-FM. I'm your host, Dennison. And you don't want to miss the next show, 2 hours of music with Rabbit Hole and Carol Seitz. I will see you all in a week, next Monday, 9 to 10. I hope you're all well, and thanks so much for listening. Take care.
Job. I keep saying that this won't happen to me, 'cause I'm free, my body, and my choice. But too scared to use. We'll be right back.